Welcome to Lipan Apocalypse, episode 12, El Día de los Gritos. I'm Brandon Seal. On October 1st, 1855, rumors reached Captains Juan and Ramon Castro at the old Lipan refuge of El Remolino in northern Coahuila that 100 or so armed Texans had crossed the Rio Grande at Eagle Pass and were headed their way. Ramon and Juan Castro and their bands of Lipanes hadn't wanted necessarily to be living in Mexico in 1855, but they were lucky to even have it as an option. Lucky compared to other Texas natives who had nowhere else to flee from Texas's increasingly aggressive campaigns against Texas Indians, supported now by the U.S. Army. It was doubly disappointing for the Lipanes because they'd been critical allies for the short-lived Republic of Texas, but also because they had tried to assist the recent U.S. invasion of Mexico in 1846. Just prior to the invasion, Mexican officials had tried to forcibly conscript Mexican Lipanes into their army, once again alienating these potential allies against Anglo-American expansion. And so instead, Lipanes became a thorn in the side of northern Mexico for the next two violent years, raiding Mexican ranches and selling the booty to delighted Texas buyers. But that didn't suddenly turn the Texans into allies either. There was this odd scene in the middle of the Mexican-American War on May 13, 1847, where U.S., Texan, and Mexican forces set aside their differences for just a few days to go out after a 65-man Lipan ranging party deep in Chihuahua. The joint force defeated the Lipanes, severed the Lipan medicine man's head, boiled the skull, and carried it back to the U.S. as a trophy. The Mexican and American soldiers celebrated with a great banquet that night. Apparently, if there was one thing that Mexicans and Americans could agree on, even when they were at war with each other, was that the Lipan Apaches couldn't be tolerated in either country. And yet the final peace between the U.S. and Mexico revealed the power that greater Apacheria still held over North America. Mexico, in effect, ended the war by selling the United States Apache lands, from the Nueces Strip all the way over to Arizona. The two countries essentially adopted the Marquis de Rubí's 1772 presidial line as the U.S.-Mexico border, which, for all intents and purposes, was the limit of effective Mexican government control at that time. And indeed, the condition that Mexico placed on the cession of territory, at the insistence of those Mexican border states, was that going forward, the U.S. would be responsible for preventing and punishing raids by Indians, i.e. Apaches, in those ceded territories into Mexico. This same Article 11 of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, ending the Mexican-American War, also stipulated that Americans, i.e. Texans, were prohibited from acquiring property, including livestock, taken by Indians from Mexicans in those raids. To oversell it a little then, but also to drive it home, in a very real sense, Mexico gave up California, Arizona, New Mexico, and its claims in Texas in order to be rid of the Apache problem. But the U.S. government didn't really have any control over Texas Indians, since those Indians all lived on Texan rather than federal lands, which hadn't prevented the U.S. government from trying to exert some form of control over them. The 1846 Treaty of Council Springs saw most major Texas Indian nations invited to a peace conference that somehow acquired the flavor of a capitulation. It must have grated on the Lipanes that these new U.S. Indian commissioners lumped them in with the Comanches, Caddos, Wacos, Wichitas, and Tawakonis, that is, their traditional enemies, especially because, as one old Anglo-Texan reminded people, quote, "the tribe of the Lipans that had befriended Texas in all her struggles, this tribe had no sins to atone for," end quote. But the Lipanes were always alliance makers, and so they dutifully attended the 1846 conference, represented by Ramon and Juan Castro. The Castro brothers sat through the proceedings as the U.S. commissioners more or less dictated terms. Namely, the U.S. government would have an unlimited right to establish forts in Texas Indians' land. Indians would be allowed to trade, but only through trading houses and through designated agents, i.e. they would not be allowed to enter white settlements, and Indians would have to submit all of their members to the jurisdiction of U.S. courts. And horse stealing, broadly defined according to this treaty, would be dealt with, quote, with the utmost severity, end quote. All of the Texas Indian nations in attendance signed, except for the Lipanes. It didn't help that while the negotiations were being finalized, word reached the Lipan negotiators of the murders of several Lipanes on the streets of Austin, causing, quote, the most heartrending national mourning by the Lipan women encamped here, loud with their shrieks which lost their sound in the distant heaven, end quote. And in fairness to Ramon and Juan Castro and the other Lipan commissioners, the U.S. agents' negotiating posture didn't respect the Lipanes' strength. Did U.S. commissioners really not recognize that the U.S.-Mexico border was a map of a pacheria? Anyone who tried to convince the Lipan captains that they were a broken people in 1846, or in 1850 when the U.S. government tried again to get the Lipanes to sign on, successfully, though the U.S. Senate wouldn't ratify this version, well, they wouldn't have gotten much of an audience amongst either the Lipanes or their Anglo-Mexican or Comanche rivals. The real proof of Apache power in 1850 was that the U.S. Army would send something like half of its entire fighting strength to Apache, Texas at different points over the next decade to try to root them out. And the U.S. Army would prove so embarrassingly unable to enforce Article 11 of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, the one committing the U.S. to prevent Apache attacks in Mexico, that the U.S. would feel the need to basically just buy their way out of the provision as a part of a second treaty with Mexico in 1854. Despite 2 centuries of warfare with Catoans, Spanish, Mexicans, epidemic diseases, Comanches, and Texians, Lipan numbers in 1850 remained largely undiminished, around 5,000. Even the Comanches had been reduced by half or so from their pre-contact numbers by this point. They'd just been set at a true disadvantage by the fact that federal non-intercourse laws didn't apply to Texas lands or to Texas Indians, which basically meant that the U.S. Army now made it their point to keep Lipanes on their side of the line of white settlement, but Texan forces were allowed to cross back and forth with impunity. In 1847, a Texas Ranger unit massacred several members of a Lipan community out on the Upper Colorado. In January 1848, 7 Lipanes were executed by a different Texas Ranger captain for a Comanche horse theft. Famed Texas Ranger Bigfoot Wallace retaliated for the theft of one mule by raising a ranger force and killing a dozen Lipanes, and then making off with several kegs of gunpowder, lead, blankets, robes, and 170 horses, a $10,000 or more payday to offset the loss of one mule. After which, Bigfoot Wallace would affirm that the Lipanes, quote, never recovered from the fatal blow we gave them on this occasion, end quote, making him yet another in a long line of enemies to have declared them, incorrectly, a broken nation. Because the Lipanes were apparently still enough of a threat that in October of that same year, a different ranger captain felt obliged to raise yet another Lipan village, killing 30 this time and making off with 200 horses as his retaliation for yet another Comanche attack. Unsurprisingly, in 1848, the Lipan Apaches finally snapped, and they went on a rampage, killing 20 Anglo-Texans over the next month between the San Antonio and Guadalupe Rivers, and rounding up at least 40 horses and mules in the process. They whipped a ranger force sent out to attack them, and actually killed the ranger captain himself in the contest. And yet every Lipan victory only justified further violence against them. In 1849, a Lipan camp near Castroville was massacred, without even the pretense of it being in retaliation for any particular raid. Quote, these bloodthirsty men, who have neither faith nor moral feeling, massacred a whole division of the Lipan tribe who were quietly encamped near Castroville. They slew all, neither woman nor child was spared, end quote, the local Alsatian priest recorded. The violence eventually brought the parties back to the negotiating table. 9 Lipan captains, including again Ramon and Juan Castro, and 4 Mescalero captains and 8 Comanches, met with 11 U.S. and Texan peace commissioners in October 1851 at the Lipanes San Sabah River stronghold. The ensuing treaty was basically a rehashing of the 1846 and 1850 treaties, which had never really been properly ratified. The 1851 treaty had one other important clause, however. In exchange for accepting U.S. sovereignty, The tribes were to be allotted land where they might live in safety. The latter clause, however, never made it into the final draft of the agreement. And the real problem was that the Lipanes and other native Texans were now dealing with settler counterparties that wanted nothing from them except for them to go away. They no longer had any true negotiating power. All they had left was the universal language of violence. The Spanish, at least, had feared Lipan numbers and needed Lipan commerce. But the 30,000 new Anglos per year flooding into Texas were almost entirely decoupled from the Texas Plains trade, which had made the Lipanes rich. Anglos sold their cotton east for American dollars, which they used to buy American manufactured goods. Buffalo hides and salt were nice, but they were rounding errors on the state's economic output. And other state and federal measures prohibiting commerce with tribes like the Lipanes had the effect of starving Lipanes of their livelihood, which had been defined for at least a century now by commerce with these settler societies. And indeed, the ink on this 1851 Treaty of San Saba had barely dried when its terms began to literally starve the Lipanes. Prior to this treaty, U.S. officers were still writing of the, quote, wealthy Lipanes, end quote, but forbidden from trading horses, hides, or anything with Anglo settlers after 1851, effectively, the Lipanes' income streams dried up. And so did their accumulated savings. They were reduced to selling their hides and jewelry and other personal effects at black market discounts just to buy corn to survive the winter of 1852 and 53. Quote, there is no exaggerating the starving condition of these Indians, and with every disposition on their part to be friendly, they're forced into predatory excursions to sustain life, end quote. Some neighboring Germans took pity on them in the spring and gave them some seed corn to plant to survive. But then the U.S. Indian agent got complaints from settlers nearby who were still uncomfortable with the Lipanes' presence and told them that they had to move. The same thing happened in the next spring in the Nueces Valley, even further west. The Indian agent that year confessed that he couldn't in good faith advise the Lipanes to plant corn at all the next year. Quote, it would be folly to advise them to make fields where they would be dispossessed in less than a year, end quote. Complaints by Lipanes through official channels fell on deaf ears. One Lipan captain went to San Antonio to complain, following the procedures established by these treaties. He was arrested for a raid that the Lipanes had had nothing to do with. And while imprisoned, one of the guards promised to kill him. The captain escaped, which for the guards only confirmed his responsibility for the raid, even though their superiors knew that it hadn't even been Lipanes behind that raid. The captain didn't stop trying to protest through official channels or to beg the U.S. government to follow through on its promises, albeit he made his protest now from a safe distance in writing. Quote, I request and desire that our great chief, the President of the United States, would procure a home for me and my people and protect us from further prosecution. We wish to raise corn, and we know how to do it. We feel like Americans and are willing to abide and be governed by their laws. We're poor and denied the privilege of catching mustangs to sell and eat, end quote. Eventually, the normally unsympathetic Texas legislature realized that it wasn't in their interest to have a bunch of starving, homeless Indians on their periphery. And since the federal government hadn't followed through on their promises of land for the Indians, in 1854, the Texas legislature established three Indian reservations on the Upper Brazos River: 37,000 acres for the various Caddoan-speaking East Texas tribes, 18,000 acres for the Comanches, and 18,000 acres for the Lipanes. Some 2,000 Caddoans and Comanches relocated to these reserved lands. But the Lipanes refused. It was an insult to their history. 18,000 acres of the millions of acres that they had never surrendered or been paid for. Plus, they understood the implication. By setting aside some land for the Lipanes, the Texas legislature had effectively made Lipanes outlaws anywhere other than their reservation. It was just as well that the Lipanes never relocated there. The Comanche and Caddoans there were so unpopular with Texans nearby that the U.S. Indian agent felt obliged to sneak them into Oklahoma under cover of darkness a few years later. And when that agent got back to Texas after the exodus, he was murdered by locals for helping them escape. 1854 would also mark the last time that Ramon Castro's Lipanes would run buffalo off the banks of Cibolo Creek outside San Antonio. Cibolo is buffalo in Spanish. A few Lipanes would return to Helotes in 1856 to plant corn for the last time there. And Juan Castro's Lipanes held out near Laredo until in 1855 they were falsely accused of murdering the Forrester family. It was actually the Comanches. Also, of raiding ranches near Laredo. It was actually the Wichitas. And of attacking a wagon train south of San Antonio, which was actually just straight-up white bandits. At the time, newspapers claimed that Juan Castro's Lipanes had killed 100 men previous month. The actual number was zero. Threatened with jail or vigilante justice, in 1855, both Ramon and Juan Castro's people fled. The very U.S.-Mexico border that Lipan Apaches had carved out now offered them the only sanctuary that they could find. And the heart of this sanctuary remained a spot along the San Rodrigo River known as El Remolino, or the Whirlwind in Spanish. The name itself a poetic echo of the Apache whirlwind that had carried the Lipanes to this spot centuries before. Remarkably, there were still some pockets of buffalo in northern Coahuila. The last herd of about 40 or so would survive in the mountains until 1900. It was also very possibly the site where the Lipanes had first learned the peyote ceremony. In 1853, the local Lipan captain at El Remolino had negotiated with the leaders of nearby Zaragoza, Coahuila, to essentially adopt the town. The Lipanes would serve to defend the town, and in exchange, the town would become a safe harbor and a market for stolen Texas goods, flipping the script on the Lipanes' strategy from a decade before, when Texians had happily served as a market and safe haven for Lipan raids into Mexico. It was, frankly, the Lipanes' only real way to support themselves at this point. Unfortunately, it gave the pretext to the 100 or so Texans bearing down on them now in retaliation for these so-called, quote, predatory excursions, end quote. So returning to where we started this episode, the Texans riding for El Remolino now were under the command of a ranger captain that Lipanes in general, and that Juan Castro in particular, had served alongside during the 1842 Mexican invasions. A man named James Hughes Callahan. And inasmuch as the Lipanes' predatory excursions were the pretext, the economic rationale for the Callahan raid was much more unsavory. The Callahan raid had been underwritten by, quote, men of means, influence, and character, end quote, which is to say, slave owners and slave catchers, to recapture some of the 4,000 or so fugitive slaves who had escaped into that part of Mexico in the first half of the 1850s. Native communities in Coahuila, like the Lipanes, had become destinations for these fleeing freedom seekers, most notably the entire Black Seminole tribe, which had also been granted land not terribly far away from the Lipanes' Peyote Hills heartland, where Ramon and Juan Castro had sought refuge the previous year. Callahan's force rode for 3 straight days after crossing the river for El Remolino, when suddenly, on October 3, 1855, 3 particularly well-dressed Lipanes appeared on the road in front of them. Callahan and the Texans froze. The Castro brothers and the Lipanes then revealed themselves in strength, 120 warriors in all, joined by a unit of Black Seminoles as well, to square off and evenly match the slave-catching expedition. The Texans prepared to charge, and that's when 200 Mexican infantry materialized on the Texans' flank. They had set the trap perfectly. A melee ensued, but Callahan's force was defeated, and the Texans fled back toward Piedras Negras with the combined Lipan, Black Seminole, and Mexican party on their tail. Callahan and his men torched Piedras Negras to cover their retreat across the river and back to Eagle Pass, casting aside their army-issued revolvers in their panic and leaving behind pretty incontrovertible proof of U.S. and Texas sanction for the raid. It was an international embarrassment for the United States, and especially for the state of Texas, which eventually accepted responsibility and paid Piedras Negras $50,000 for the damage caused by it. And it was really a high point of Mexican and Indian collaboration in defending the integrity of Mexico's borders. And yet Mexican officials drew different conclusions. Reeling from yet another Santa Ana presidency that had just ended, 1855 saw the rise in neighboring Nuevo León of a new caudillo, a new leader, Santiago Vidaurri. He had come of age as a Federalist, but by the time of Santa Anna's most recent removal, Vidaurri had recolored himself, as had many Federalists by this point, as a liberal, but a liberal with very expansionist dreams. After becoming governor of Nuevo León in 1855, he invited Coahuila and Tamaulipas to join Nuevo León in a sort of superstate, resurrecting the old northeastern interior provinces idea from Spanish colonial days. And when those states demurred, he sort of just annexed Coahuila. And for Vidaurri, the 1855 Callahan raid demonstrated how vulnerable northern Mexico was to another American invasion. And if the presence of fugitive slaves and predatory Indians was the excuse that Americans would use, he decided he would do everything he could to eliminate that excuse. Because it was also a fact that Mexican Federalists retained their own frontiersmen's mistrust of Indios Bárbaros. And indeed, the continued presence of migratory Indians on their peripheries made a mockery of their pretensions to being a modern, industrializing state. Governor Vidaurri immediately opened lines of communication with U.S. Army commanders in Eagle Pass and Laredo. And he sent a message to the Lipanes that they would be personally blamed for any further Texan incursions into Mexican territory, and that, quote, the least complaint for damages caused on either side of the Rio Grande would be the signal for their extermination without discrimination of any kind, end quote. Which must have landed as a gesture of supreme ingratitude amongst the Lipanes to whom it was directed. Also, it was the kind of impossible to comply with directive that an old Spanish colonial administrator would have been proud of. How could the Lipanes control what the U.S. Army or Texas vigilantes did? They wouldn't have to worry about that. Because on March 19, 1856, without any particular provocation, and just months after the Lipanes and Mexican forces had fought side by side to repel the Callahan raid, Governor Vidaurri's forces descended on a Lipan town just outside the old Mission Santo Nombres de Jesús de Peyotes. Caught off guard along the banks of a creek with the ironic name of Gracias a Dios, the village of 60 Lipan men, women, and children didn't put up much of a fight. They surrendered, and Mexican forces executed 30 of the men immediately. The Lipan women, realizing what awaited them, then took an extreme step, unparalleled in the history of the Lipan people. Supposedly, they began slitting their own children's throats. There's no account anywhere else in the historical record that I've seen of Lipan suicides or mercy killings, even in the most desperate situations. Had the Lipanes reached their breaking point? Were Lipan women so displaced, in particular, from their roles in a traditionally matrilineal, matrilocal society, that they snapped? The Mexican commander used the women's actions at Gracias a Dios as justification to execute another 11 of the Lipanes, including some of the women. A week later, a desperate collection of Lipanes tried to retaliate on a different Vidaurri force on March 22nd. They too were defeated, and inadvertently led the Mexican forces to yet another Lipan settlement of 74 people. There, once again, the women supposedly started murdering their own children, which once again, too, served as the Mexican commander's justification for executing countless dozens of Lipanes on the spot. Though the fact that we haven't seen this kind of behavior anywhere else in the Lipan experience makes you wonder if it wasn't just a pretext for the Mexican officers to thin the ranks of their captives. The survivors were carried off into captivity, sold most likely to ranchers, who prized the Lipanes' famed skill as horsebreakers. Quote, the history of the Lipan is brought to an end, end quote, Vidaurri's government proclaimed, joining a long and distinguished line of administrators to declare the end of the Lipan nation. Of course, it wasn't the end. It was clear, however, to Juan and Ramon Castro and the rest of the Lipanes that there was apparently no more security in a Mexican homeland than a Texan one, and that the only security they might actually find would be to remain in constant motion back and forth across the border that both Americans and Mexicans agreed was neither American nor Mexican. So following the Mexican massacres of Lipanes at Gracias a Dios and other locations in northern Coahuila, Ramon and Juan Castro and the other San Antonio Lipanes retreated up into the Devil's River, back in Texas, in July of 1856. Some of them tried as far over as the hill country one last time. In 1858, some of Ramon Castro's people would try to plant corn near Camp Verde in Bandera County, but a U.S. cavalry patrol found them and destroyed their crop. And yet, the U.S. Army was still pretty outmatched by the Lipanes in terrain like the Devil's River. Old Texans like Rip Ford snickered at the U.S. Army's struggles to learn how to conduct mounted warfare against, quote, the best horsemen in the world, end quote, as he and many others considered the Lipanes. These years against the Lipanes in West Texas would lead to the formation of the first true U.S. cavalry units. And these units were led by an array of men whose names would become famous on battlefields of the American Civil War. The John Bell Hoods, the George Buells, the Earl Van Dorns, commanded from back in San Antonio by the Robert E. Lees and many others. And Ramon Castro's Lipanes would beat back every one of them. Then, in 1861, it all stopped. The Bluecoats disappeared. The Rangers disappeared. The frontier fell silent. And a remarkable thing happened. The level of violence dropped dramatically. Neither the Confederate government nor the Texas state government had the resources or bandwidth to launch major campaigns against Texas Indians. There's a popular perception that this podcaster has unfortunately perpetuated that the line of white settlement in Texas retreated significantly during the Civil War. And yet, the statistics don't quite back that up. Or rather, if the line retreated, it wasn't because of increasing violence, rather more likely because of economic and population declines caused by the war itself. There were indeed some raids on settlers' livestock by unknown Indian perpetrators during the Civil War, but far less than in the pre-war years. And many of these raids might just as likely have been Anglo bandits, it's unclear. It seems that what mostly happened during the American Civil War was that the Lipanes, at least, returned to their old lifeways. In fact, there was a bit of a boomtown around a major Lipan trading hub up on the Upper Concho River that served Comanche, Mescalero, and Mexican traders during these years. But when the Civil War ended in 1865, the great American war machine, now more powerful than ever, directed its energies against Native America. The U.S. Army returned to West Texas in 1867 at Fort Lancaster on the Pecos River. The Lipanes immediately coordinated a 900-man Lipan, Kickapoo, and Mexican force that even boasted a few disaffected ex-Confederates, and they gave the Bluecoats a little welcoming party, reminding the Army that they would have to fight differently out here. And, indeed, the U.S. Army came up with a new and more effective strategy in their fight against the Lipanes. They would use the Lipanes Coahuilan neighbors, the Black Seminoles. According to one scholar, quote, recruiting the Black Seminoles was the military's most effective single move against the hostile tribes, end quote. The Black Seminoles weren't Seminole Indians per se. They were escaped American slaves who had allied and intermarried with the Seminoles back in Florida during their years of fending off the U.S. Army there. After the Seminoles were shipped to Oklahoma in the 1830s, the Black Seminoles came with them. But there, they were made to feel unwelcome as neighbors by their old Seminole allies, and soon heard about an offer from the government of Coahuila for free land if they would come and live in the state and help defend it against Indians like the Lipanes and the Comanches. The Black Seminoles accepted and performed their part admirably for most of the 1850s. But by the 1860s, the Coahuilan government's grand promises of land grants had yet to fully materialize, and the Black Seminoles were increasingly viewed with the same suspicion that Mexican liberals viewed other Indians. The U.S. Army, stationed in Fort Clark near modern-day Brackettville, picked up on the Black Seminoles' dissatisfaction and recruited them as scouts to ride against the Lipanes and other natives holding out in West Texas. The U.S. also had their own version of the old Spanish pan or palo, the bread or a stick policy. While they were preparing to fight the Lipanes, they were also trying to negotiate with them. Sort of, mostly by declaring that they wouldn't negotiate anymore. In 1871, the U.S. Congress declared that the U.S. would no longer recognize Indian tribes as even being capable of making treaties with the U.S. government. It meant that Native Americans were no longer domestic dependent nations. They were squatters on their own land, and their choice was the reservation or extermination. The U.S. government actually sent commissioners to northern Coahuila in the spring of 1873 to seek out the Lipanes and lay out their options for them. The Lipanes told them to pound sand and refused to, quote, entertain any proposition to limit their place of residence, end quote. The Lipan commissioners returned from this council to their people camped in the canyons of El Remolino. As they had been 18 years earlier in 1855, Captains Ramon and Juan Castro were both there with their people, along with other captains from the resident Big Water Lipan Band, and even some Kickapoo and Mescalero Apache allies, some 180 houses strung out over several miles in the canyons of El Remolino, translating to something like 1,500 people. Unlike in 1855, however, in May of 1873, this group had no forewarning that 377 U.S. cavalry troopers and 24 black Seminoles under the command of a Colonel Ranald McKenzie was bearing down on them. Of course, why should they have been on guard? It would have been a particularly sinister thing for the U.S. Army to cross an international border and attack a peaceful camp of Lipanes at the same time that U.S. peace commissioners were in the town next door offering terms. But the U.S. force was being led through secret, unguarded passes by a young Mexican military officer named Antonio Menchaca. I actually can't confirm this Menchaca's genealogy, but it definitely calls my attention that he has the same last name as the six or seven generations of Mexican and Spanish officers before him in this region, all of whom counted on a famously close relationship with the Lipanes. It also might explain how he knew exactly where the Lipanes were camped and how he was able to lead the U.S. troopers in secret against them. The first indications that the Lipanes had of the attack that morning of May 17, 1873, were the sounds of screams from the Kickapoo camp 400 yards away and the smell of fire. A U.S. Army lieutenant remembered later, quote, "the fierce crackling of the flames mingled strangely with the carbines, rifles, cheers, and yells," end quote. El Día de los Gritos, Day of the Screams, the Lipanes would remember it. Immediately, Lipan families scattered, seeking out foxholes that they had dug for precisely this purpose and covering themselves where they could with sagebrush. But the soldiers came on, shooting indiscriminately, and once they learned about these brush-covered foxholes, they started bayoneting and firing into those as well. Many Lipanes escaped, but many didn't. When the smoke cleared, 42 Lipanes had been captured. 19 were dead, including old Captain Ramon Castro. Two of his children, Jack and Caseta, were captured and sent off to the notorious Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania, never to see their people again. Juan Castro's wife, Francisca, was also dead, but Juan was only wounded. His children, Juanita Manuel and Calixto, had carried him to safety. Over the next few months, they made their way to the Rio Grande Valley and settled in and around Reynosa and tried to lay low. El Día de los Gritos was a traumatic day for the Lipan people, a day that they would never forget. And yet, the Lipanes, by 1873, may very well have outnumbered Comanches, in whose final defeat the next year, the Lipan and allied Tonkawa scouts played a very prominent role. A Lipan sergeant known to history only as Johnson located the Comanches' Palo Duro Canyon hideout and led the U.S. cavalry to them. After the Comanches' defeat and subsequent surrender to reservation life in 1875, the Lipan Johnson was rewarded with 40 horses for his role. In general, though, the Lipanes remained more resolved than ever not to give in. After the massacre at El Remolino, they sent a message to U.S. Indian agents that, quote, "they will never make peace again, and from this time forward, they will war with the whole world," end quote. The U.S. and Mexican governments took the threat seriously. The years between 1873 and 1881 would see three Mexican army campaigns and 11 U.S. Army cross-border incursions intent on exterminating the remaining Lipanes. And they would all fail. For all their skill as merchants, as horsemen, and as warriors, the Lipanes' greatest strength remained their alliance-making. And the Lipan aura still preceded them everywhere they went in Native America. And it would make possible for them a survival strategy into the next century that, frankly, wasn't available to any other Native group in the United States. On the next episode of Lipan Apocalypse. Thank you for listening. Editing for this episode was performed by Susana Canseco. The intro and outro music is from the White Mountain Apache Crown Dancers. You can find them on YouTube. Special thanks this season to my Lipan friends, Bernard Barcena, Lucille Contreras, Richard Gonzalez, Margot Moreno, and Gary Perez. I hope I'm doing your story justice. And make sure to check out Lucille's Texas Tribal Buffalo Project online and fill out her Texas Indigenous Data Sovereignty Study. For more information about the Lipan Apaches, check out the books by Thomas Britton, Jose Medina Gonzalez Davila, Nancy McGowan Minor, and Sherry Robinson. Also, check out the doctoral thesis of Enrique Maestas and the Texas Observer article by Dylan Bedour. Lastly, go to Gorka Alonso's website, apacheria.es. For more information on my other projects, you can go to brandonseal.com.